So astronomers are tending to the view that life beyond Earth is not rare, but that very likely in almost all cases is microbial life, as it was on Earth for 3 billion years.
Welcome to the Book Society podcast, where we talk to interesting people about interesting books. It's really that simple. Okay, here we go. It's the Book Society podcast. My name is Lucas Cantor Santiago, and our guest today is the distinguished professor Chris Impey. He is, in fact, a university distinguished professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona, which has to be a great place to do astronomy because you got lots of dark stretches of nothing to look at.
300 clear nights a year.
Wow, amazing. He is the author of 220 publications on observable cosmology. That is a lonely number to me, but it seems like a lot of publications. His research has been supported by $20 million in NASA and NSF grants. So NASA and the NSF think he's got something interesting to contribute to the society. He's won 11 teaching awards. He's created an online course that has been enrolled in by 370,000 people. He's written over 100 popular articles, 2 textbooks, 1 novel, and 9 popular science books, including Worlds Without End, which we're going to talk about today. And there's so many things in this book that I want to ask you about. I'm not sure whether the right thing to do is to orient the listener in the scale of the book, because it's about the observable universe, essentially, which is, I guess to say that it's astronomical in scale is actually quite literal, but it's also figuratively astronomical in scale. I think the first question I want to ask you is, where is everybody?
It's a good question. It's Enrico Fermi asked that in 1950, and we still don't have an answer. So I'm setting aside the UFO believers and abductees who think they're already here or they've been here. But I'll just say I don't think that happened. It's a good question. And the absence of visitations or evidence of intelligent technological aliens or civilizations may mean that they are quite rare. So astronomers are tending to the view that life beyond Earth is not rare, but that very likely in almost all cases is microbial life, as it was on Earth for 3 billion years.
And when you say rare, this is the thing that blew my mind about your book and just about anything, anytime you investigate anything to do with astronomy. How many habitable planets are there estimated to be in the universe? Let's start with our galaxy.
I was going to say, you're going for the big number first. Well, in our galaxy, and this is all extrapolation, as scientists do, because the body count of exoplanets sitting at about 5,300, most of those are within a few thousand light years, which is actually our backyard. The Milky Way is 100,000 light years across. But that's a good enough sample to project. And basically, it's in the range 10 to 20 billion habitable worlds in the Milky Way galaxy, just our galaxy.
So life being rare, so rare that we would not be able to see other life, would mean that it's 1 in 20 billion.
Exactly. Now, the caveat is that it's hard to see other life. And that's sort of where the research has moved to now. Just increasing the body count of exoplanets, we're going to do that, but it's not too hard. And all we know about almost all of them is their mass or their size. Very simple. So the hard experiment that's underway now is to inspect them, in any number of them, in enough detail to see if microbes have altered their atmospheres. And that would be a detection of life beyond Earth.
Wow. So tell me if I've got this right, and just correct me if I've got it wrong. But so you are observing stars with incredibly powerful telescopes, and you observe over a period of months or years that there are periodic dimmings in the stars, and you're able to zoom in on those and then extrapolate color spectra. And that's what tells you the composition. Like those dimmings are presumably planets passing in front of the stars, and you can figure out what color they are, and that is what scientists use to extrapolate what they're made of and how big they are, et cetera.
Right. So the dimming is kind of simple. The planet moves in front of the star every orbit, and its cross-sectional area covers the star by some fraction, and that tells you the size of the planet. So getting the size is easy. Getting the mass is easy by a different method, where the star is tugged on by the planet and it has a little Doppler shift in the same period as the orbit, so you can get the mass. But doing the life detection experiment is really an extra step, and it's a hard step. So that planet passes in front of the star and dims it slightly. That's how you measure its size. And, but that starlight will filter through the atmosphere of the planets. It's sort of backlit by the star. And then you've got to take that very feeble light that makes its way through the atmosphere of the star and smear it into a spectrum. And that's a difficult experiment. But if you can do that, then you can see what's in the atmosphere of that Earth-like planet. And that's the experiment that people are trying to do now.
Well, so Earth-like is like size of the Earth, far enough away from the sun to not be on fire and close enough to not be completely frozen.
Habitable. Astronomers have a kind of traditional, you might say, simplistic view of habitability. It is literally the appropriate distance from whatever star it might be so that liquid water could exist on the surface. That's it.
Wow. Okay. So we're looking for life, life that is... So one of the things I thought about, because as a sci-fi nerd, so Drake's equation addresses this, that time is also a factor, because we've been... Let's see, we have been, as human beings, able to detect other life for a century, maybe, in theory, right? I mean, I guess we could have gotten a radio wave from another planet 100 years ago that we might have interpreted as something else. And that, in the astronomical scale, I mean, if there was a civilization that lasted a million years but became extinct 200 years ago, we would almost be contemporaries, but we would never have heard of them. We would never find them. So they have to exist in the same relative stage of development as us at exactly the same time. And that's got to decrease the chances of finding habitable life or finding extraterrestrial life, right?
That's right, because the distance between stars is so large. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're looking at stars that are, like I said, even our backyard is thousands of light years away. So a signal from a civilization on that planet has taken millennia to reach us. And of course, they may not exist by the time we get a signal. So I think the argument generally is that unless intelligent civilizations are really densely populating the galaxy, we're not going to have contemporaneous communication or probably any communication. So the fact that we don't know of their existence and we don't see the sky littered with their radio waves or their sentient probes or whatever they've sent to us implies they're kind of rare and thinly spread out in the galaxy. And that means the distance is of time are also large, so contemporaneous doesn't really apply.
What kinds of planets are we looking for when you're looking for habitable planets?
Well, astronomers will look for everything. They want a full census to know what the true population is. It's interesting because it turns out it's not hard to find Earth-like planets. Essentially, on average, every star has roughly one, as our sun does. But interestingly, the most common single category of exoplanet is a super-Earth, so a planet that's two or three times the size and five or six times the mass of the Earth. And there isn't one of those in our solar system. Venus and Earth are essentially twins, and then you bump up factor 8 or 9 to Uranus and Neptune. So the most common type of exoplanet in the universe, we think, doesn't exist in our solar system, which is interesting. But what's probably more interesting is that super-Earths are probably just as habitable as Earth. They hold thick atmospheres. They have geological activity, which we think might be important for biology. And so, you know, you add those two categories together and you basically have 1 in 3 stars with a habitable planet. And that's a huge number because there are 400 billion stars in the galaxy.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is habitable for life, not necessarily habitable for human life, right?
No, that's just a bare bones definition of habitability. And in fact, many of the exoplanets are really extreme. Some of them are super hot. You know, some of them rain molten lava or diamonds. There are some very exotic exoplanets that people like to talk about that are most definitely not habitable by us or maybe by anything.
Yeah, and I guess one of the, you talk about these extreme environments. You start the book by talking about extreme environments on Earth, and life does form in many of those, in all of those places, in some form. And I don't remember if this, no, this was, sorry. So we read this great book. We talked to author Tony Hiss last week, and he wrote a book about life and the environment. And one of the interesting things that he talked about was the Methuselah microbe, which is so strange and exotic that we didn't even know it was alive for a long time. It just takes a million years to metabolize, anything. And if something like that, if something that is alive by our definition, but so exogenous to us were to exist, is it possible that we would ever find it?
These are going to be very hard to find. I mean, microbes, you know, for instance, people estimate that the subsurface biosphere of the Earth, life inside the rocks, could exceed the biosphere mass on the surface. And we can't find that at all astronomically. So if there's life underground, as there might indeed be on Mars, there might be life right now in a subsurface aquifer on Mars, and we don't know about it. And our little rovers dig, they scratch around the surface a few inches, but these aquifers are 10, 20, 30 meters down. So it could be in our really in our backyard, and we wouldn't
know. Oh, wow. Do you think that Elon Musk is going to succeed in his mission to colonize Mars?
He said he wanted to die on Mars. I think I buy that. It's quite possible. He has a messianic streak, as we know. He could succeed. In his lifetime, he could succeed. I mean, he's, you know, he obviously vastly underestimates difficulty, timescale, cost. But he also achieved some amazing things. Well, you know, his big rocket blew up, but we shouldn't forget that his Falcon 9 workhorse rocket has had something like 130 successful launches in a row. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Rockets blow up. It happens.
It's part of the, for the people who do it, as long as there are no humans on board, it's fun.
Yeah. What do they call it? A rapid unscheduled disassembly?
Yeah, that's a good one. That's for the, that's one to keep in your memory.
But I guess I would agree. I believe that he could die on Mars. I don't know if I believe that we could live on Mars. So when you're looking out into the universe and you see a Mars-like planet, does that count as habitable to you? Because Mars has some semblance of an atmosphere, right?
Right. And so in general, in planetary terms, Mars is sort of barely habitable. It's on the edge of habitability. And that's because it's low mass, so it lost its atmosphere. It's geologically mostly dead. And it's obviously super cold. You couldn't have liquid water on its surface right now. So, and yet there might be life underground. So Mars is right on the sort of hairy edge of habitability. And we've seen plenty of planets like that, you know, around other star systems, but people are focusing their attention on the things that we really think might be habitable.
Hmm. How long have humans been involved in the search for life on other planets?
I mean, the ideas go back to the ancient Greeks who speculated about life beyond Earth, that why would life on Earth be unique? This was enough to get Giordano Bruno, you know, burned at the stake in 1600. So these are not always popular ideas with the conventional hierarchy. So hundreds of years, and the tools have really only become available for us to answer the question fairly recently. So that's why this field is taking off now. It's really driven by technology.
Yeah, I loved in your book that you started with Lucian of, how do you say his name? Lucian of Samosata?
Lucian of Samosata.
Lucian of Samosata, who is I thought me and my friend were the only one who'd ever heard of him, frankly. I have a friend who wrote a play about sort of a theatricalized version of his journey or of his fictional journey.
Right.
And
early science
fiction. It's 2,000-year-old science fiction. It's fascinating. It kind of has a Baron von Munchausen vibe is kind of how it feels to me. It's very fantastical. I had not made the connection that, like, you know, someone 2,000 years ago was thinking like, oh, there might be some kind of life or something on the moon or just on these other planetary bodies. It's interesting that the field has existed for that long. We're pretty far from the closest planet to to Earth, right? Alpha Centauri is the closest star system.
Right. And Proxima Centauri, which is a red dwarf, it does have small planets. We don't know if they're habitable. That's really hard to measure. But there's a good bet that there are habitable planets in the nearest star system.
Hmm. How long would it take to get to Proxima Centauri?
Well, the Breakthrough Starshot project is trying to do that. So the Russian industrialist and billionaire Yuri Milner, he sort of salted the mine with $100 million to challenge astronomers and technologists to send nanobots to Proxima Centauri. Use beamed microwaves from the Earth to power solar sails attached to tiny little spacecraft, 1 gram or so, accelerate them to 5% of the speed of light, and then bang, 40, 50 years, you get to the nearest star system. And then you have all the sensors on those nanobots look for life. So it's actually getting to the nearest star, you know, maybe not quite within our lifetimes, but within a couple of generations. It's a real project. It has enormous technical challenges. I'm not going to say that it's all doable, but he's got very smart people on his advisory board, and they're kind of working the problem.
I was going to say, how realistic do you think that, because the way you explained it, nanobots, sure, no problem. I've seen those in movies. Microwaves, great. I've got one in my house. No problem. Put them together. You got a starship. So, but how realistic is this in reality?
It depends on extrapolation. You know, they are extrapolating Moore's law. They're extrapolating miniaturization of technology. They're extrapolating our ability to beam microwaves, all sorts of things. They're extrapolating everything at once to get to this goal. And it's probably not feasible in that sense, because something is going to go wrong. Something will come off the rails and not work as they planned.
Wow. And so, Ed, what would be the... So at 5% of the speed of light, I don't know if this is in your calculational expertise, but wouldn't there be relativistic time dilation? So like, wouldn't it feel to the nanobots like they had been traveling for 1,000 years by the time they got there? Or is it the other way around?
Actually, 5% is small relativistic effects. I think relativistic effects are fractions of a percent. So it's really not. You have to get up to third or half the speed of light before these things get big. And they can't do that. The energy cost is too high. I mean, they would go faster if they could, but I don't think solar sails could ever get you much faster than 5%.
Do you think that there's a way, this is now we're entering the realm of science fiction speculation, but do you think that there is a way to travel faster than light?
No, I haven't drunk that Kool-Aid. I was trained as a physicist, and everything I've read says that even the Alcubierre warp drives that were making the physics literature a decade ago, those have not been debunked, but I think they've been sort of deconstructed as not plausible. So physics would have to be wrong in some very basic way for that, for us to be able to go faster than light.
Yeah, which means that Alpha Centauri in the fastest conceivable spaceship would be 4.5 years away. In the spaceship that could go like asymptotally close to the speed of light.
Right, fastest conceivable. And the energy costs of that are just staggering, especially for big objects. The whole idea of us traveling to Proxima Centauri, it's just off the table.
We'd have to turn the asteroid belt into fuel, basically.
It doesn't work. So the remedy, the thing you have to do, of course, is go the other way. You have to take us down to suspended animation and just let it take centuries or millennia.
And I guess if you're going to do that, you're going to have to be really sure that the planet you're about to land on can support life.
Well, we all got to go some way, and that's a pretty good adventure. So, I mean, if you did go on ice and got there centuries or millennia later, all your friends and relatives would be long dead anyway, and you got to some weird exotic place, and if it didn't work out, oh well, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I on the one hand agree with you, but just like take the perspective for a second, Chris, of this astronaut, right? Yeah. So you go through this training, you do all this stuff, you get into the spaceship, you're in low Earth orbit, you put yourself in suspended animation, right. And from your perspective, you wake up 2 seconds later and then just die on a rock. And with the knowledge that everything you know and love has already died centuries ago.
It's disappointing, but life is full of disappointments.
Yes, life and indeed the universe is full of disappointments. So I found, let's see, do I have another question for you? Can you just explain, I mentioned it briefly, but can you, you do a deep dive in your book, but can you explain Drake's equation?
Sure. It was put together by Frank Drake, who died a couple of years ago. He's an iconic figure in astrobiology. He was a postdoc in Green Bank Observatory, Radio Observatory, and he gathered in 1960, at the time, all the world's astrobiologists, nine. There were nine of them. Carl Sagan was one. And he wanted to brainstorm how we'd know if there were intelligent aliens out there and how we'd put those pieces together. And just in real time, he went up to the blackboard and wrote an equation that combined all the factors that get multiplied together to give you this number N, the number of intelligent communicable civilizations in the galaxy at any given time. So very clever formalism and clever thing to do. It made his name, it's attached to his name and so on. But it's also, as he put it, a container for ignorance, because there are seven factors in that equation. Some are numbers, some are fractions. And we don't know four of them, and we may not know them for a long time. So when you multiply the three things we do know from astronomy by four things we have no idea of, the answer is we have no idea.
Yeah. I remember I'd heard of it years ago, and I thought, oh, that's pretty clever. And I didn't really realize until you explained it that like four of these seven variables are guesses at best, I guess.
Barely guesses at best. Yeah. Now, Frank, on his, he was a sort of optimist. They call him SETI's, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, optimist or pessimist. Optimists mean they think there's a lot of people out there. he on his license plate, his California license plate, he had N equals L. And that simplifies the Drake equation with all those factors turning into basically one, the number one. And then the number of pen pals equals the lifetime, the average lifetime of a technological civilization. So that's a very interesting reduction of the equation because it tells you how important longevity is for companionship.
Can you just go a little deeper into that, N equals L?
Sure. So, you know, the numerical factors that go into the Drake equation, as I mentioned, some have been measured by astronomy. How many stars are born every year? How often a star has planets? How many Earth-like planets per star? We've now measured those numbers. And then you multiply by the fraction of times there's a habitable planet that life actually happens, because it might not in some cases. And then by the fraction where that life becomes intelligent at some point. And then the fraction where the intelligence develops technology at some point, because, you know, whales and orcas and elephants are pretty smart, but they're not going to have telescopes and spaceships. And then the final factor is the lifetime of the civilization. And he was just arguing, as others did at the time, that all those intermediate factors, you can take plausible guesses. There are guesses in a few cases. And then they all sort of boil down to essentially one, around one. And so this equation simplifies to N equals L. And then you can draw the conclusion that companionship depends on durability of a civilization.
Well, yeah, because we've had stargazing telescopes for, what, 1,000 years-ish?
Yeah.
Less?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's...
400 years now.
In astronomical terms, that's nothing. I mean, we could have...
Well, and the sobering thing, of course... if we project from a sample of one, is that we probably don't have a stable technological civilization. We've had nukes for 70, 80 years, and we still have more than enough nukes to destroy us. And we have biological weapons now and climate change. And, you know, so our L, if you like, is about 100 years, right? A century of modern of computers and space travel. It might not be much longer than that. And then L is a small number, and the number of civilizations around the galaxy is a small number. So people are pretty lonely.
Hmm. Yeah, the other thing I think about sometimes is that other races just might not experience time the way we do.
Yeah, I like that one. That's another good science fictional idea. The idea that, and it was one famous Star Trek episode, where you could have creatures, intelligent creatures, whose metabolisms are super fast, or super slow. And we would not experience either of those extremes. They would just be, we'd be blind to what's going on with them because it's either happening so fast we can't perceive it, or it's happening so slowly we don't notice any changes. But that's an interesting possibility.
Yeah. We're going to wrap up this discussion of Worlds Without End, and we're going to come back next week and talk about Wonderful Life, Stephen Jay Gould's award-winning book from 1991. The Book Society podcast is brought to you by me, Lucas Cantor Santiago, and produced by Chris Peters. We do new episodes on Fridays. We have a lot of episodes. You can listen to some back catalog. If you like the show, please give it a review. You can review it on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. It takes a few seconds. Helps out the show, helps other people find it, and we really appreciate it. All right, see you next week. Yeah, we can't have a 300-year-old curriculum. What is this, history in Florida?